I'm going to ask all four of the artists here, please, to introduce yourself, give a little bit of background, what you're doing. I've also got books to show, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. Hi, I'm Matt Kent. My last book was Super Spy, and I'm working on a new book for Dark Horse called Three Story, The Secret History of the Giant Man. It's actually, I'm not working on it. It's done. It's coming out in September. But, and my first books were Pistol Whip and then Pistol Whip, The Yellow Menace, and then Two Sisters was the book in between those and Super Spy. And all my stuff is kind of set in the 40s and I guess has some historical aspects to it.
Terrific.
I'm Jim Ottaviani, and I write nonfiction comics about scientists. I've been doing that for about a dozen years now. Yes, it's 2009. And what I'm currently working... It's hard to know what you're currently working on as you make the transition from a self-publisher to working with larger places, because what I'm currently working on, I finished 2 years ago, and the artist is working on it, and it'll come out next year, so people will say, your new book is about Richard Feynman, which is what it will be about. And that's coming out in 2010, and then a book about Diane Fossey, Jane Goodall, and Baruti Galdakas, the three primate researchers that pretty much broke open primate research in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That will come out from First Second in 2011. And so those are my new and upcoming books that I finished 2 years ago.
I got the opposite work pattern. I'm in the middle of a trilogy about Berlin, Germany in the 20s, called Berlin, and the two of the three books are done. The next one will be done in about 4 years. It's just being written, so none of the art is done at all. And I teach at the Center for Cartoon Studies in Vermont, which is a comic book school up there. And I just finished a project with working with Ben here about Amelia Earhart through Hyperion.
Which we have an advanced copy of.
I'm Ben Toll. I've done two historical fiction comics. The most recent one was the Amelia Earhart book that I did with Jason and a writer named Sarah Stewart Taylor. And my previous book was called Midnight Sun, and it's also a historical fiction a graphic novel. I'm apparently the go-to guy for 20s aviation disasters.
All right. Well, basically, I want to ask you guys, I want to start off with the general question, okay? The question I want to ask you is, when you're sitting down to do some historical work, what is it that basically intrigues you? Is it an episode? Is it a particular era? Or is it basically a kind of a theme that maybe perhaps runs through all history? We'll start with you.
Okay. I think it was an unconscious thing when I first started. I think I was attracted to the 40s because I'm a big fan of old movies, like all the old Bogart movies and film noir and stuff. So, in high school, that's all I watched. So when I started out, I think it was just superficial because I like to draw the cars and I like the clothes. But then as more books came out and I'm still stuck in the 40s, there's something else there. I'm still not quite sure what it was. I know, I don't know, to me, I just like that era. There's a lot of pivotal things that happen, and there's just a lot of... I like the music from that era. I don't know. I guess...
Good thing you're doing comics.
I'm trying to figure out why I'm doing it while I'm talking to you. So, but I think what I really like about just history in general and the 40s in particular is... all goes back to this movie I saw a long time ago when I was a kid, Westworld. And the thing about that movie was I love this idea where you could go to this time and you could live as they lived and then pretend you're in that era and everything. And so I think that part of why I do comics not set in present day is to give me sort of my own little Westworld where I can pretend I'm living there and figure out what it's like. And it basically gives me an excuse to do a bunch of research and read about that time and what people were like and what life was like. Sort of live during that time while I'm doing the book. That's probably why.
You mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 36. I was born in 73.
I assume your parents would have grown up during the World War II era?
Yeah, here's another interesting thing. In my new book, the three-story book from Dark Horse, is set in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, so it goes through three eras, and it's it's the most personal of my books because I based a lot of it on sort of my dad, who was born during World War II, but his parents got married and then he got shipped off to the war and then he died over there, and my dad was born while he was over there, like right, I think he was born like right before he died, so they never saw each other. So that's one of those story, like family stories that always kind of stuck with me, this idea of, you know, having this kid and then you've never seen him. And what was the question again? So my parents were born then, and yeah, that's it.
Skip it, Jason.
He's making a joke about aviation.
Oh, I gotcha. I gotcha.
So what does attract me to this and why? I've lost the question already.
Sorry about that. The basic gist is, you know, you think of historical comics or you think of what you can be doing with your comics. And I know you were a philosophy student, if I'm not mistaken, at one point.
No, I was a nuclear engineer. Which is it's far away.
Once again, I'm posing the question. I'm so sorry. But basically, the question is, why are you attracted to the things that you write about?
Right.
Because history is such a broad thing. Why these specific things? Why do you get your message?
Yeah. So even though I was teasing you, you actually did deliver the perfect segue. So I was a nuclear engineer for many years. And if anybody's ever seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, over the course of much of the movie, they're being chased and constantly looking back and saying, who are these guys? Because there's a guy, you know, what are these people doing? And throughout most of my studies, I felt like I was being chased around by people named Einstein, Bohr, Heisenberg, Schrodinger, all these folks, and eventually got to be interested in the people themselves rather than just the equations and the discoveries they made and the impacts of those sorts of things, and began to read about their lives, began to read about the milieu in which they lived, and it's, you know, some of it is that really attractive 1940s period where the hairstyles were really hip and the clothing was really good and there was, you know, a clear good and evil thing going on, and all these things sort of build up into the notion that there are stories here. And comics owe so much, oftentimes, to fake science that I got interested in the real science and seeing that happening in comics. And, you know, engineer, pretty good at math, liked comics, always read it. But it took a while to, you know, like, do the equation. Comics plus science equals question mark. And then I did that and waited a while and waited a while. And finally, you know, as probably many people here have had happen, one day you wake up, you're brushing your teeth, and you're saying to yourself once again, why are there no comics by scientists? Who's going to do this? And it's like, oh yeah, it's that guy. You know, it's the one in the mirror. And then you just start going. So it's the people behind some of these things that really attracted me, and finding out that they did lead interesting lives in interesting times, and that their stories were worth telling. It's not just about the equations.
For me, my first book, Jar of Fools, was... it was very internally driven. It was semi-autobiographical. It was about the world that I lived in as a 20-something art school graduate. And after I finished it, it was kind of a cathartic working through of my own issues. And after I finished it, I said, you know what? I want to do something about something completely different than me. I want to go outside of myself as far as I can get. And but I didn't know what that was going to be. I just had this real desire to engage with the larger world. And I had a public high school history education, and I went to art school, so I didn't really know that much history. I hadn't read or studied history really much at all. And I was just reading a magazine one day, and I saw an ad for a book about, it was called Bertolt Brecht's Berlin, and it was about Berlin in the 20s. And it was just mainly a collection of photographs. There wasn't a whole lot of text. But I saw this ad, and I was like, okay, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. And it's going to be 600 pages long. And I'll get it done by the time I'm 40. I'm 42 right now. What was that?
I'm sorry, how many years have you been doing it?
12 years. And the more I read about it, I didn't really know that much about the Weimar period. I had a pretty vague, I know some of the people that were in Germany at the time, but I had a pretty vague notion of the specifics of like dress and the kinds of details that you're talking about. So I came at, and then the more I read, I didn't know what the story was going to be, but the more I read, I spent about 2 years doing research, just reading and focusing on 1927 to 1933, and not reading anything about anything that happened after 33, and reading a lot of actually, you know, history of the country up until that point, in European history. I did read some general stuff about that, but and after sort of absorbing all that information, some stuff started to filter up. And what I realized in retrospect is that some themes or ideas, it was more about, it wasn't about specific styles of things, although that's obviously a big part of a visually driven medium, and that's a big part of the way my book looks, but there were ideas that were happening at the time or ways that people were thinking that that became the themes of the book, like radio was a whole new thing, and the idea of what radio waves do and what mass communication, how it changes the world and culture, those ideas were the things that started to motivate my storytelling. So it was more about, and also, I mean, the political situation at the time, like how did Hitler come to power? What are the specifics of that? In high school, World War II was covered one day where, or the Holocaust, I should say, was covered one day where the teacher, my teacher who would go get big gulps from the 7-Eleven and then pour vodka into them, he's like, okay, today we're going to cover the Holocaust. And then he'd like get his big gulp and he'd put in a videotape and like leave the classroom. And with no preparation, and I had no idea, I grew up on the West Coast where like, you know, Jewish culture and Jewish people aren't as visible, or at least weren't then as they might be in the East. And we sat there and watched the videotape where like bulldozers were pushing bodies into trenches and stuff. And I was like, you know, I just couldn't, there was no, it was, wasn't an education. It was like, you know, shock therapy or something. It was weird. So part of the impulse comes from just wanting to understand, not, you know, there's so many World War II movies and there's so many, the period of the war itself has been covered in such incredible depth and detail. And of course, when you dig a little bit, there's an enormous amount of material about the time leading up to the war, but I really wanted to engage with, okay, that happened, but why? And not only that, but what are the basic, not the specific cultural and historical reasons, which can be traced and can be described, but like what are the basic human reasons that happened and why, what are the threads there that still apply to us today? Like what about human behavior, which was true then, is still true, and how can that be addressed if it can be at all? So it was more of these larger questions that I had, and then I decided to address that through specific characters that were, I tried to make them as different from me as possible, but you're always there anyway, you're always in all of your, every one of your characters is some aspect of you, and you can't get away from that. So that was the basic.
You want it, actually.
You what?
You actually want it. It makes it more authentic.
Yeah, it does make it more. Yeah. Right. You've got to be drawing on something that you do feel. Yeah, I do agree with that. So that was my. That's how I came into it.
I guess the appeal for me is just, I kind of stems from, you know, when I what sorts of narratives I like, you know, and the things that I like to read or see in a film. I find really appealing to just to sort of suddenly be immersed in a different world, you know. And I think that's also why I really like science fiction a lot.
Westworld.
So that's well, you know, like I mean, I grew up in the '70s, so you know, Star Wars was a big thing for me when I was a kid. And I think one of the appeals of the first Star Wars movie is that they don't explain everything to death, you know. And I like the fact that you can sort of drop into this world, whether it's science fiction or whether it's some era in the past, and just suddenly be immersed in it. And I think, you know, also as, you know, as cartoonists, we tend to like to sort of construct worlds. We tend to like to sort of world build, you know, as I think Jason's pointed out before, there's a surprising number of cartoonists who were also probably as kids into like role-playing games and stuff, because that really allows you to work that part of your brain. So I find it really interesting to sort of construct visual worlds that are not the world that we're in right now. And I think kind of the third element for me is that I really like the process of discovering things. I mean, I like kind of reading stuff and discovering things and kind of connecting the dots. And, you know, I also had just zero interest in history when I was in high school. And even in college, I found it really boring. And I just, you know, like even in college, I just took the one history class you had to take to get your, you know, your foundation, your liberal arts thing. And I think it's because, you know, when you take a history class, that's the element of history that you don't get, like, the discovery, you don't get to discover anything. You just get to, like, memorize stuff that other people have discovered. So it's like, for me, when I started doing, you know, when I started doing Midnight Sun, I really enjoyed, like, digging around and just finding out bits of information about things that I didn't already know. And I think that's probably the third prong of why I find historical comics so interesting.
Now, if you guys bear with me a second, I know this is going to sound silly, but I've been laughing the whole week because I work with all these kids that are in their 20s, and I'm 50, and it's a culture shock. And suddenly I do realize that when I'm at home, I'm going somewhere with this process. When I'm at home, suddenly there's no more beer commercials on the shows I watch, and there's no more truck commercials. It's all mattresses and bone loss. Point being is, I find that I'm falling into my demographic. Now, one of the things I'm finding from all of my friends as we get older is we're drawn to the history channel, drawn to the military channel. I wasn't before. I always had liked history, but, and here's where I'm building to a question, too. The question basically is, as you get older, do you look at the history differently? Does it affect your storytelling? That's part one. The other thing, I can't remember this before. The other question is, how much do you get involved with the history through the art? In other words, in English classes, we know they always make us take the piece of literature, and we always had to look at it in the historical context. I would have to assume most of you studied art at one point, and I have to assume there was always art history class. Does that affect your storytelling? And again, does it change your perspective as time goes on and as you're published?
Should we get the non-artist out of the way first? Because I only write.
Yeah, go.
Sure.
Do it.
So, again, getting back to my background, there wasn't an art class within 40 miles of my intellectual upbringing or study. But the art does drive what you do because we're all working in comics. And so I think oftentimes the genesis of a story idea is an image or scene realized visually for even me, so even though I'm not going to be drawing it. Seeing a picture in my head of what a page or a sequence might look like certainly does push me into particular stories. As I grow older, have things changed? I don't know if they have. I expect I'm a pretty poor judge of how things have changed, other than I hope I'm getting better at this. But again, I'm probably a bad judge of that. And given, I think that all of us are working in the relatively distant past in our books. So one of the things that I think is important to, at least for me, is to be sure that there's enough time in between today as I'm writing this and the story I want to be telling that I can find, if not the truth of the story, at least one of the truths of the story. And you can only get at that. And it's not just a question of facts, because you're always going to have to leave stuff out. And I think as Ben was talking about the joy of doing all this research, one of the hardest things is stopping and saying, all right, time to write the comic book, because there's always going to be one more book, one more thing, one more whatever to look at. But one of the joys of doing the research is, like, finding that story thread through something that, you know, the Weimar Germany, it's incredibly complex. And you could pick any, you know, it's a choose-your-own-adventure. And you could choose whatever you wanted to do. But finding the thing that's going to be meaningful to you is the important thing. So I think the only aspect of aging and getting older is letting some of these story ideas mellow to their full flavor consistency, letting them breathe if they were a bottle of wine.
Yeah, I guess as I get older, to me, the true gauge of me feeling older is sitting in a coffee shop and listening to 20-year-olds talk to each other, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm definitely old. And so I don't know what that has to do with my comics, except that I know that I feel like that my early stuff, I definitely I had a more shallow outlook on both my storytelling and my art. Like I I had these ideas. It's like, I want to get these ideas, or I want to draw a guy in a diving suit. So that would be this, you know, that's the basis for the story. But as I got older, and I did do more research, and I would read about, you know, real people's lives and everything, and I think my focus shifted from drawing cars that look cool to trying to figure out what was London like during the Blitz, and for a single woman, you know, which I think that's me just getting older and being a little more interested in the depth of character, so it changed sort of my reading habits, and my research was definitely a lot better.
I'm with you, man. Again, I'm sorry if I didn't.
Stop apologizing, Abby.
Sorry. What I meant though is I look at Jar of Fools, okay, and then I look at Berlin. Again, we're going from something introspective to something that's yours. I look at Pistol Whips, which again, there's genre traffic, but then you jump into Super Spy. Jim, yeah, you are a little bit of the kind of
Jim's consistent. Always improving, but.
Ben goes from. Farewell, Georgia, correct?
Yeah, folk tales.
Which were folk tales, but then you went to more of a real historical drama. And the point I was trying to make was, as I get older, I'm more attuned to history, or why, maybe because I'm part of history, because I've lived more, because I relate to my parents. I'm not sure, but it's certainly happening to me, and it's happening to everybody else that's aging with me. And I'm sorry if I wasn't clear on that question. Look. That's why I asked if you, as you get older, as you move on, are you being drawn more toward historical fiction, or is it really not an issue? And that's how I'm thinking.
Sorry to jump in, but right now what I'm writing is fiction. So I'm regressing.
Wow.
I'm turning into... Yeah.
All right. That's great.
We'll see you.
The basic phenomenon you're describing is, you know, when you're young, your circle of interest tends to be pretty, you know, pretty close. It's your circle of friends that, you know, what kind of clothes you're going to buy, what kind of music you're going to listen to, and then... Sometimes, as you're describing, it's happened to you. You get older, and you start to care less about that stuff. You know, maybe, you know, like I'm wearing cutoffs and a black T-shirt and some ratty tennis shoes. Like, you just sort of care less about how you look, or at least I do. And my concern just started to be more about, well, how does the world work and why? And I'm in it, and maybe I can do something about it, or maybe, you know, my curiosity will take precedence over my own. Sort of more selfish concerns, maybe, is how I would maybe think of it. Like, get away from... but it's funny, because when I started it, which is like now 12 years ago, so how old was I? I was 30. When I would go to cons and people would meet me for the first time, they'd always say, oh, you're a lot younger than I thought you'd be. Because of the subject matter, like, who's going to write... And there were people saying, like, why is he doing that? Like, come on. Who cares about Berlin and the... Because at the time in the 90s, the indie comic scene was very youth-driven. I mean, it still is. It always will be. And that's one of its strengths, I think. But it's very much about, you know, slackers and very, very, very limited, a very limited demographic in terms of usually, you know, young white men. And that's changed a lot over the years. But and I realized that I have a little old man living inside of me, and I always have. And if you've read Jar of Fools, Alf Lasso is the little old man who lives inside of me. And I got in touch with him, and now he runs the show. And in terms of our art background influences stuff, like Ben was saying about world building, a lot of times, and Jim was saying how, like, he'll have an image, and that'll be maybe the basis for a scene or the inspiration for part of the story. Comics is largely visual medium, and when you get into it and you really start to, instead of like, if somebody writes a script or a screenplay and they hand that to you and they don't think visually, a lot of times you have to change a lot of stuff around to make it work. Like, one of the great, wonderful things about working visually is that if you're pouring over photographs of, you know, street scenes or whatever, and then you come across an old phone booth, and you're like, wait, what is that thing? And then there's no book that says this is an old phone booth. You just find a weird object on the street, and you have to sort of deduce what that thing is. And that aspect of, you can't get that out of a history book. You can't, like, your curiosity can lead you down certain realms in the world of prose that historians have written. But when you're looking, you're poring over these pictures, you really become a kind of detective. and you start to figure out. Like I remember, I found some larger cityscapes of Berlin, and at the time, they would take pictures, photographs for postcards, and there was a lot of. They would process the photographs to remove a lot of the less attractive elements, you know, like the equivalent of airbrushing. They would remove or they would colorize stuff. And in all of the postcards, I got to a certain point, I was like, wait, like, at this point, Berlin was totally electrified. Where are the electrical wires? And then I found, when I was in Germany, I found some old, somebody took me to an old newspaper office, and I was able to look through their old, their morgue of old photographs. And, like, the skies were filled with electrical wires. And there were these crazy, like, it would be a pole as high as this building, and, like, halfway down the pole, you'd get the little transformers or the little insulators, the little glasses.
Yeah.
So, like, there would be a curtain of electrical wires, like, running over the rooftops. And in all these photographs I had been looking at, there was no sign of it. Like, they had actually been sort of erased from history, like Zelig, you know, like, or like Stalin had done. And, like, it was just, you just find these amazing little things. And then that trip, you know, then I think, well, who are the people that worked on those electrical wires? And it takes you down these roads and sort of areas of investigation that you wouldn't have arrived at if you just read it, if you didn't look at pictures, you know.
So a lot of it's just the creative process.
Yeah, and historians don't care about that stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I was always fascinated by, like, phone numbers and, like, dialing the phone in 1942. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's crazy, and that's hard to find that information out, you know?
Those little subtle details.
Wait for the dial tone.
Yeah.
Anymore. What is the dial tone
thing? Yeah. Or, like, what it, it's really hard. The hardest thing that I have to find is, you know, the things that have survived history are photographs of landmarks. And we all know what those look like. But what does somebody's bathroom look like? You know, like, and that's what my characters, it's very much about the lives of these characters. So I need to know, what did a frying pan look like? You know, if they were going to grate potatoes for potato pancakes, what kind of grater would they use? And those kinds of details are really, really hard to find. But looking for them can be really, really great. One more story. I don't know if you know Ben Catcher, this really wonderful New York cartoonist who got the MacArthur Grant. And there's this really great strip called Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer. And each one of these strips is a little meditation on urban living, a little sort of poem about some aspect of living. And oftentimes they're sort of semi-fantastical, but they're very grounded in the idea. Like, he did a whole strip about the little black circles that end up in sidewalks because of chewing gum. You know, like a sidewalk off of these black circles, and you may not know it, but it's chewing gum that gets mashed into the cement and then turns black. And he did this really great strip about newspaper weights, these cast lead or iron newspaper weights that newspaper vendors on the street, they'd get a stack of newspapers delivered and they'd have these iron weights that they put on top of them to keep them getting blown away in the wind. The time that he wrote the strip, those things didn't exist. They had like these racks that would close on the top. There were totally different ways of doing it. And in fact, he invented, using his imagination from being immersed in the history of that city, he invented this idea of these newspaper weights. He'd never actually seen one. Right, so it was just like, well, how did they do it back then? He was using his imagination to come up with like these things, and then, oh, that'll be a funny little story about this imaginary newspaper weight. And then it went on about the sort of industry behind it in upstate New York and how it produced these weights and the different kind of stamps they would put on them. And then he got a couple of letters from guys who had worked in that industry. It was a real thing, but he didn't know it was a real thing. He was so immersed in his world that his imagination produced something that was real. And then people actually wrote to him and thanked him for commemorating commemorating the forgotten newspaper weight. It's so catcher too. And that, I just thought it was a testament to like how when you're so immersed in that world and you're creating this world, you can actually find some truth, you know, some real thing there, even though you didn't know it was real.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a whole lot to add that hasn't been covered, other than to just, I think I'd also agree that one does tend, later in life is more fertile ground for getting interested in things historical, just because you do tend not to be quite so self-focused. I would agree that there's sort of something about the cartoonist or, you know, people who are interested in comic books tend to have a slightly obsessive personality, and I think that there's something appealing about history because it does allow you to really get into the sort of minutia of you know, kind of day-to-day life in some period that you know nothing about, you know, and particularly when, you know, a lot of books that you read about history do tend to just kind of hit these big big themes and in some ways I think tend to sort of impose an order, a kind of a cause and effect order to things that in some cases may not really exist.
Yeah, right.
And so I think that, you know, the way that you can kind of get, the way that you can kind of counter that intellectually is to kind of become interested in the sort of day-to-day existence of people, like he was talking about, like, you know, a single woman, you know, during the Blitz in England. So I think I would agree with everything that's said so far, and just, I think it's an interesting paradox that as you begin to get a little older and a little sort of less interested in yourself, and you get more interested in sort of history in general, you also kind of at the same time, particularly if you're sort of a cartoonist type, I think also tend then to get real focused on little tiny details of those time periods.
And yeah, in Midnight Sun, the main character isn't really one of the historical characters. You created a person.
Yes.
An artist, a newspaper man, a failed,
yeah. Well, I mean, like they were saying before, I mean, every character in a book is to some extent, you know, kind of a cipher for the author. You know, it is like, you know, I mean, I did talk about, you know, how much I like sort of the process of discovering things. You know, and it's like, you know, that's what a reporter does, is discovers things. You know, and I think that's why it's also kind of a cheap narrative device too, which is why there's so many movies and things about reporters, because, you know, the process of you know, putting together a narrative is to sort of slowly feed out bits of information to the reader at kind of a measured pace, so that they're going to be interested in what the next bit of information is. And if you have a reporter as your main character, that's a pretty convenient way, because what he's doing is, you know, getting little bits of information here and there. So,
yeah, but I think you're forgiving. I understand what you're saying, but I think you're selling yourself short, because I think that was for the sake of that story and out of all the things we're talking about. I would say, by definition, yours is the closest to historical fiction, i.e. Mm-hmm. You took a fictional, actual moment in time, mm-hmm. and you created a historical moment, mm-hmm. and created a fictional story with a fictional character around it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the whole story is about a discovery, and yet the whole book really ends up being about his personal discovery.
Yeah, well, because I think that ultimately, you know, any big historical event is ultimately about decisions that individuals make. You know, it isn't, you know, history. People, you tend to see history portrayed as this sort of force, you know, the force of history. Well, you know, there is no force of history. There's just people like you and me making decisions that have results. And, you know, that's, I guess, why, you know, that's why I find a lot of, like, movies, for example, about historical things, a lot of times, big Hollywood movies, to be sort of unappealing, because they tend to have to set things up as these big kind of epic, you know, struggles where the hero does something breathtaking at the end. And it's just, that's not often the way things work. And those aren't the sorts of stories that I think are, to me anyway, the most affecting. You know, when I read stories about history, I'm more concerned with, like, individual people and what was going on in their heads and what they were thinking about and what made them make the decisions that they made when they did. And so I think that's why.
I find that heartbreaking in a way. And in other words, in Berlin, you know, when you set up the entire magazine. Oh man, reading that issue, I believe that was issue number 6 or 8.
Eight.
And it was brutal. I was mad at you. I was like, you made me care about this.
Absolutely.
So how do you guys make that call? And I guess part 2 would be, do you ever go back and rewrite if you do research and find out you got something wrong?
Yes.
After the fact, after it's been printed?
Oh.
Second editions?
Second edition.
Or do you mean like at the script stage?
Certainly at the script
discover
stage.
Stuff and go back
if you
and
discover
and,
stuff yeah. that's gone wrong. I've only written one book that is in some measure, in a large measure, fiction. And it's to find that beginning, middle, and end is where you, when you realize that you still like the characters, you still like the overall theme or message or whatever it is that you're, you know, it's this book, and I just like the notion that there was a war between paleontologists over dinosaur bones in the Old West. So that's cowboys awesome. And dinosaurs.
That is awesome.
That's a book I needed to write. And it wasn't for Jason's little old man, it was for my 10-year-old boy inside me. But as when doing the research, I realized that there wasn't enough conflict there that was overt, and some of it sort of petered out in ways that were dramatically unappealing. So that's when I started to, you know, shift my shoulders a little bit and tweak things. I tried to play fair. So in the back of the book, there's, you know, a whole section that says fact or fiction, and call out where it was fact and call out where, well, you know, P.T. Barnum did meet these guys, but he met them later than I show up. But he probably did have this conversation based on whatever. So it's mainly to the point of doing a book for me, probably for everybody, is to get a story out there. And when the story isn't satisfying enough, when it's hewn strictly to the facts, that's when you start. That's when I start, anyway, tweaking it.
And you have every right to do it too.
Yes, because
God damn it,
because I
here.
It's my book. Right.
Yeah, I think I probably play faster and looser with the facts than. I've gotten a couple of emails from, you know, history buffs that are, you know, upset that you changed this or that. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, for me, it's just about story and about communicating clearly, you know, and I'll take things out and move things around and just make stuff up. I've noticed a weird, since my first historical book came out, I've noticed a kind of strange thing about graphic novels, which is that nowhere in my book does it say, like, this is true, you know, like this ever happened, you know, the true story of the Airship Battalion. But there is a sort of assumption, I think, that people don't make with novels or films for some reason, that if you're doing a graphic novel that's related to history or takes place in the past, that it's true. And which I did a long interview with somebody who that was their whole, like, you know, why did you change that? What, you know, aren't people going to be mad? And I just was like, I didn't say it was true. And, you know, it's like people don't, I don't get the idea that, you know, when people went to see, you know, Titanic, that they really thought that every single thing that happened there was true. I mean, I think that people, you know, assume that it's going to be like, you know, a fictional story set on the backdrop of an actual historical occurrence, which is what, you know, that book is, and it's what the Amelia Earhart book is. And it's peculiar that people have those different expectations. And I wonder if maybe it's just because there are so few.
That's the reason.
Yeah, there's just so few sort of historical fiction graphic novels that there's just not a critical mass of them enough for people to understand that, you know, that there's a difference between trying to do something to the extent that you can actually even do kind of a 100% true, you know, graphic novel about something. I feel like, you know, that's just really an impossibility. Not just because of the old, you know, any story twice told is fiction kind of thing, but also because, you know, I think that we have an additional problem with because of the visual nature of comics in dealing with history. You know, if you were writing a prose historical fiction thing and you just say all that was known was that on such and such a date Abraham Lincoln stayed at the so-and-so hotel, well, then you just write on, you know, on such and such a date Abraham Lincoln stayed at the so-and-so hotel. But if I have to draw that, you know, I have to draw the inside of the hotel. I have to draw what Abraham Lincoln's wearing. You know, presumably he would have spoken to someone. You know, it's like all that stuff, it's got to come from somewhere, and it, chances are, is not historically accurate. You know,
that's what,
like,
Richard Geary's for.
What's that?
That's what Richard Geary's for, to do that.
It's right here.
And I will say that, like, a lot of times your art style, like, I would imagine that Matt probably does not get a whole lot of, because you have more of a cartoony style,
yeah,
right?
I will say I work the opposite way, where I, like, to me, the historical stuff is the raw material for my ideas. So, like, I'll do a bunch of research, and then I purposely don't case that stuff in the, you know, at a specific date. I'm super vague on my dates. Like, there are certain points in my book where I know that's the day in history that's going to take place because that's what happened. But I don't ever put that in my books because I don't want to me, I don't want my books to be about like the historical accuracy. I don't want to get emails about, you know, this wasn't, you know, that didn't really happen. I'd rather have it, like my book, there's a lot of stuff that's real in there, but I want that stuff, I pick the weirdest real stuff and I put that in there so people don't even question, like, there's like a three-man sub and they go to try to stop this nuclear stuff that the Nazis are working on, which all that stuff is real, but that was like crazy. It looks made up. Like in my book, that's the most made up looking part in the whole book, but that's real. And then there's another scene, there's another story where it's the English had this dead guy who was a spy and he had a heart attack or something, and so they stuffed his pockets full of like fake codes and everything. And then they dumped his body in a river in Germany for the Germans to find, and hoping that they would find it with these codes and everything. And the Germans found it, and they found the codes, and they're like, oh, we got all these secret codes. And so they used that for disinformation. So they used those codes and purposely sent fake stuff, and the Germans got it, and then they were confused, thinking they were, you know, all that. And that was a real story. So I took that real story about this dead guy, and I was, but then I just told the story of his wife's point of view. Like, what's his wife thinking about him, them using his body and all this stuff? So, to me, it's the history stuff's raw material, and then I just sort of use that to make up stories that I want to tell.
Now, Jim, you've had a little bit of a challenge, though, opposed to, we have Super Spy, which, I, you know, again, we've got maybe 10, 15, 20 stories, 20 vignettes, that some merge, some don't, really creates an overriding arc. We've got Berlin, where you've made a setting, created a lot of characters that represent everything from the communists to the non-communists to the socialists, and it creates all these different sections of society at the time. And again, you've taken a more historical viewpoint by creating a fictional character that encountered a historical fact and created a novel out of it. For you, and I realized that you were talking about the one with the dinosaurs. But what about, like, let's say with the ones that are almost more, in a way, like almost illustrated textbooks? Bad choice of phrase. What I'm thinking of is a
you just one. Broke my heart, but yeah, it's okay.
And you know something? I am going to take a fast aside here because one of my favorite cartoonists ever. And I recommend to everybody here, I hope you guys like him as well, is Larry Gonick.
Yeah.
Larry Gonick is the one who got me interested in history, basically into history, because he made it so much fun. It's factual history, but he pumps in jokes. Right when you need it, there is a laugh out loud zinger, and suddenly you come away going, boy, did I learn a lot. While I was reading Suspended in Language, mm-hmm. That's challenging. It's about Neil Bohr, and basically pretty much about the atom, and you'd explain one part, I mean, you explained it beautifully, and the page was laid out great, and I got it. Next page, got it. Then you went back to the first one, and I'm like, I'm an idiot. And I kept going back, and why did you, it was me.
It was probably me too.
Well, my question for you is,
if it didn't work.
The challenge of actually taking rather dry material, mm-hmm. challenging, difficult material, and turning it into something exciting as a graphic novel. What are the challenges? What are the ways? What are the stumbling blocks? Do you have 10 seconds?
Then it's just going to be dead air. Well, the challenges are the same challenges that I think everyone faces in trying to get ideas out onto a piece of paper or onto a screen. In that making, especially getting back to, you know, I teased you a little bit about philosophy major, but a lot of what we talked about and did in Suspended in Language is almost just this far from pure creation of mind. Our inability to visualize what's actually going on inside an atom and what electrons are actually doing is one of the problems with teaching, learning, understanding, enjoying physics and modern physics. And that was one of the points Niels Bohr would always make, is that if you think you understood it, you're probably wrong because you can't, and it should make you dizzy thinking about this stuff. And so some of what we were trying to do is make you a little dizzy in reading the book, and then you'd have that full experience of working with Niels Bohr on this. And that sort of notion is going to show up again in the Feynman book, where he's gonna. That's really weird to talk about because he's been dead for 20 years, but he's going to do this thing in my book. And he's actually very alive for me now still. But talk about this notion of trying to present these ideas to an audience, and the challenge is to not let the audience turn off because they don't like it, it doesn't look right, it's counterintuitive, they don't understand it. And one of Feynman's catchphrases, it's not a catchphrase, but one of the things he would often say about trying to explain, trying to show these sorts of things is, you don't like it? Who cares? You don't understand it? Who cares? I don't like it either. I don't understand it. But this is the way the world is. So I think I'm not answering your question in the sense that I don't know whether I actually addressed any of these challenges other than to use the words of the people as they were trying to present these rather complicated and arcane ideas, use their own words and be true to the characters. And if it falls down a little bit in terms of making you understand it, at least in terms of quantum mechanics, that's okay because nobody else does either.
Right. I'm looking at that, and I'm actually following up on your question as opposed to trying to submarine it there. But I remember my father-in-law telling me that he met Niels Bohr when he was an undergrad and thought he was just a complete bastard.
Really?
Yes. Because he sort of was always sort of, focused on, not himself, but so...
In his head.
In his head.
In his head, if you were talking
in his own world.
Away, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think of then the movie A Beautiful Monologue, which was supposedly, I guess, on the BS meter, well over 75%, but it made for a pretty darn good story.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
And my question for you, as opposed to for the other three who are working in that fiction, when you were working on the ones about the scientists, did you veer off center very often? Did you take any licenses? Did you, for the sake of either storytelling or for a little bit of humor, get into it? Love the Isaac Newton. I think that was a really nice.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Clearly, in some cases, you veer way off center. You know, there's the, for those who haven't seen it, pretty likely that you haven't, but there's a story about Isaac Newton and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the two co-inventors of calculus, and they had a long-running dispute about this, and Sean Bieri, the artist, and I set this dispute in an English pub, and it's a bar fight. So that didn't happen, but it was funny. So we decided funny is better than accurate in that situation. But for the most part, try to get pretty close to what actually happened and hope that the enjoyment of the characters and the way they're presented and their personalities will carry you through the bits that you don't love as the science-y bits that you may or may not love as much.
Leibniz was a philosopher, was he not?
He was.
Mm-hmm. I just had to point that out as a philosophy major since there was some dissing going on.
There was no dissing.
You're just saying there's a distance between.
Yeah, there's
an engineer.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. We've only got time for one more round of questions. I want to know if anybody else wants to ask somebody before I dive in. All right, so here goes. These are going to be individual questions for each one. I've got to tell you the truth, but I read Super Spy. Loved it. I was actually almost bummed out when I went back when I was doing some investigation for this panel, and it said that this was a fictional piece. I was I was so wrapped up in it, I was actually hoping they were real spies. And I really, it's that much fun to read books, and you can read it sideways. You can read it from beginning to end, or you can read it going by the cases. That said, I jumped then right into Two Sissies, which I believe you did first, right? And I, again, recommended very, very highly. Noticed a distinctive cartoony style between the two. I looked at Super Spy very much like a 1940s kind of, or almost a 50s noir kind of feel to your art. Two sisters, basically, I don't raise your eyebrows. I almost felt in a lot of ways it was Bergman-esque. It was almost as if Ingmar Bergman was creating a spy book. And I want to know, basically, what were you consciously using two different styles? Who did you base your styles on? And how did they feed off each other?
I will, part of that is just me naturally getting better at cartooning. So that's probably one of the biggest things. But then with Two Sisters, in every book, I guess, I sort of set up these weird challenges for myself, formal challenges when I'm doing a book. And for Two Sisters, that was a book where I'm like, I want to do a book that has no captions in it, and I also want to do a book that uses every single page as part of the story. So the front cover, inside cover, all the way to the back cover is a panel of the story. So to me, that whole book was sort of an experiment to see if I could tell this one long story with no real breaks. I cheat a little bit. There's like little chapter breaks every once in a while, but I don't cut from scene to scene even in that book. It does go from era to era, but then usually that's like a visual link, and I don't do like a, there's no like hard break usually. There's not like a black page. Well, there's a couple of those, but I tried to make it such a smooth transition that it's just the whole thing flowed as one long thing instead of, okay, now we're back in Roman times, and now here's the pirates, and now we're back in the 40s. And so doing that without captions sort of changed my layout style and then the pacing of the story. If I'm in France and then I gotta go back to England, I had to figure out a way to do that, and usually it was just traveling over the English Channel, visually, and then zooming in on another character. So, I think a lot of that was just sort of these formal challenges I'd set up for myself when I was doing that book. And then with Super Spy, it was a book I was going to do it in color, so I wanted color to be have a big part in the story, so I would shift color depending on where the story took place, and it was just a completely different kind of animal. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Terrific. Jim, for you, I know this is a pretty generic one, but I think it's important because the two books I read by you were so distinctly different.
Okay.
If you had to pick the one book of what you've done so far that you would recommend, or would like everyone to read first, in other words, you'd say, this is my book, this represents my work. And secondly, whom of the great minds, the great thinkers, the great scientists that you have not tackled yet that you want to tackle next?
So that's almost the favorite book question, and so since you copped to doing the generic thing, I'll give the generic answer. The next one will be the best book. I'm pretty happy with the book we just did about the space race, T-minus, and I worked with the same guys that I did the Bone Sharps book. Worlds apart, literally. prehistoric times in the Old West versus low Earth orbit to the moon and NASA. So I'm happy with those. A book that I would like to do, and I'm happy with those, and I would recommend those as perhaps the most accessible and thrilling stories that I've put together. Although, making an atomic bomb is kind of, you got all the risk you want out of a story in something like that. A thinker that I'm working on and actually have more than just a sketchy outline for is a guy named Alan Turing. And people who know a little bit of computer science or even have not know about probably the Turing test, which is how one of the metrics that scientists have proposed and named after him as a way to determine whether a computer is actually intelligent. One of the interesting things that you would learn about Turing and the Turing test is originally people mostly presented it as if you got a computer in a room and you got a human in another room and somebody questioning those two things, having an interactive conversation, can you tell which is the computer and which is the human being? The actual Turing test is, can you tell whether you've got a man or a woman in each room if you've got the computer in there? And given that Turing was a gay man in pre- and post-war England and suffered the ultimate in persecution for that eventually, and that his life was... There's just so many ironies in his life. He was instrumental in the war effort and in breaking, speaking of codes, breaking the Enigma code, which was the German naval code. So he had done this great service to the country. Then he is prosecuted for being a homosexual. And it's like persecuting Dwight D. Eisenhower for something. If people had known that he had made this contribution, probably this wouldn't have happened, but he had promised not to tell and didn't tell. And it's just like this whole ball of secrets and intrigue. Yeah, it's just an amazing story. And then, yeah, and I hope I found an interesting way to do this. But so yeah, that's on the horizon.
Just one fast aside before I get up thinking the one thing you could have added into the mix there was that would have been a gay computer like an alpha.
Well, I mean, to me that is one of the ironies of the way the Turing test is now perceived, and given that he had created it, and there's this gender, it's all knotted up, and I think it'll be very interesting. Hope it.
Jason, I could talk about Berlin all day long. I really could. I could, because as I was saying, every time Berlin comes out, I tend to read the entire series again up to that point. But my last question for you involves a book I've just lost. I wanted you to go, could you tell us a little bit about The Handcuff King, Houdini, how you came about writing it, what it's for, and is it available on your booth, in your booth, and what
is it? It's not at our booth, actually. It's Hyperion, Scholastic Hyperion puts it out. So, and they're doing the Amelia Earhart book as well. So you have to go to their website or go to a bookstore to buy it. It's a day in the life of Harry Houdini. And actually, going back to your question about, you know, where does the facts end and the fiction begins, and how do you work on that relationship? And what it really comes down to for me is finding a kind of truth. And obviously it's a truth, only a truth that I think I have found, and maybe it was true in the factual sense, maybe not, but I try to find things that feel true. And in the case of Harry Houdini, there's actually no real believable account. All of the biographies of him, he was such a master showman in the first place that his entire career is a kind of fiction. He'd let on. There's very, very, very little evidence or any a real record of who he was like, what he was like as a person to just have a conversation with. It was all incredibly controlled. So, and I've always been really fascinated with him for lots of reasons. But I chose to just do one day in his life, and instead of one of the more spectacular things he was really well known for, it was basically a work day for him, which is he spent a lot of time touring the country, jumping off of bridges. Shackled to an iron ball that would carry him underwater. So it was just like, you know, it was like a working day for him. And what was that like? Like from morning to evening, what was that day like? And so I did all the research I could about this specific jump into the Charles River in Boston in 1908. But there was just so many gaps that there was a lot of room to fill.
The way you handled his life and his death. Everybody should read
that. And actually, that's a really great example. So there's a what's the word? Apocryphal story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Apocryphal means it's attributed but can't be verified.
So there's an apocryphal story about how, well, he was basically the world's greatest locksmith at the time. There was no question that he was the greatest locksmith on the planet. And that was essentially his greatest skill, but it's not something people really think about. And he knew all the world's locks and how to pick them. And he narrowed down his toolkit to a very select few number of picks. For a given situation, he'd figure out what lock they were going to put on him, and then he would have that pick on him somewhere. And a lot of the locks he could just get out without a pick at all. Like, he knew there were some handcuffs, you could do that, and you could get right out of them. In fact, there's a really... I won't go into that. So many great stories about Houdini. And there's an apocryphal story about how he would do these escapes where he'd be completely naked, which at the time was like, you know, turn of the century, this guy's getting completely naked in public. He was just like such a complete kind of freakish outsider and totally fascinating for a lot of people. Also Jewish, which was another weird aspect of his career. But his wife, Bess, who he was incredibly devoted to and attached to and who was absolutely integral to everything that he ever did, but you never really hear about that. The story is that for some escapes, he would kiss her before he would try to get out of something, and she would pass him the pick and the kiss. In fact, Kate Bush wrote a song about it called "With This Kiss I Pass the Key," and that to me is just such a great, you know, it's a great metaphor. It's just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. And I built the whole story around that, but no idea whether it's true or not. I mean, with him, you'll find completely. And this is the great thing, going back to historians giving their version of cause and effect, and you read enough history books and you realize that, like, you know, everybody, and it's written with such authority and with such definite voice that, like, oh, this must have been the way it happened. And then the more you read, the more you're able to sort of see that it's just this mosaic, and, like, you can start to fill in those gaps between, you know, what people say actually happened. And he was just it was a really fascinating exercise for me in trying to figure out what is true. And I also made him kind of a jerk, because I feel like he had to be a really hard guy to be around, because everything was absolutely controlled. And, you know, down to the last detail, and he was just absolutely hardcore about it, and he had no patience for any kind of imperfection or failure. Like, you were out. As soon as, if you worked for him, the first time you did something wrong, no questions asked, you're on your ass. But nobody ever talks about that either, you know, that he, as a person, what was he like? So I just became interested in just a couple details about, you know, his obsessive compulsive personality, what was it, just like a day in the life? Like, what would that have been like? And then that took me to that story.
And the final question, Ben, is for you. Can you tell us three really great things about Amelia Earhart that are going to make us even more want to watch you read the book? And secondly, was there a plan with that? The fact that Amelia Earhart is hotter than a pistol right now. Was that planned, or did that just...
I'll take the last one first. I think that was purely coincidental, but, you know, those people at Disney are no fools. I think that not only is Amelia Earhart kind of hot at the moment because of that Night at the Museum thing, but I think there's also a movie coming out, I don't know exactly when, with Brad Pitt and...
Hilary Swank.
And Hilary Swank as Amelia, and I'm wondering whether, you know, the book isn't coming out until February of next year, and I'm wondering if, you know, somebody in the top office of some Disney thing kind of decided that'd be a good time to put it out, because that movie's coming out around then. I'm probably not the best person to ask about Amelia Earhart in particular, because I didn't write it.
Well, in other words, I was looking for more preview of the book, since it's not for sale.
I will say that one of the reasons we tapped Ben for this project is that his and, you know, to typecast you as the historical aviation guy, his handling of a cartoonist who can handle the dynamics of flight in a convincing and believable and gripping way is a rare thing. Hayao Miyazaki would be top on my list for that. But what Ben did with Midnight Sun sort of showed us...
He was busy, apparently.
Yeah. What Ben did with Midnight Sun convinced us that he would be a really, really great candidate for the job, because you needed it. It's about flight. It's about her taking off, and there's a scene in the book where we sort of have a flashback to her first flight that she ever took, and why that was like that guy that took into her and made her become an aviator. And Sarah wrote it out as the first flight over Los Angeles, and I can't remember what year it was that she did that.
It was 1916 or something like that. I can't remember. But
and
yeah.
We were like, okay, aerial shot of Los Angeles. Go, Ben. You know, that's the great thing about writing a script. You can say, okay, one line, aerial shot of life, two-page spread, aerial shot.
And that's like 3 days of your life.
3 days of your life. Write it off.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, my final point will be, although I did not write it, it is something that, even if I had nothing to do with, I would want to read, because it's the kind of biography that I like. I don't like biographical stories of the sort that are parodied by the Dewey Cox story, you know, where, like, if you want to talk about a historical figure, you start with the day the historical figure was born and then follow them through life, you know, until they die. You know, because I don't feel that I don't think that that's the best way to get at someone's character. I feel like the best way to get at it is to select some particular very small event in their life and really dig into that, or just select some particular moment or some particular decision and really get into that, and that's how you get a character for me. And that's true whether you're talking about, whether you're talking about fiction or history, and it's weird to me that a lot of times when you see a narrative that's historical, that seems to go out the window. You know, you would never, you know, go see, you know, just a regular movie that starts with the character's birth and ends with the character's death. The only time that ever happens is people feel obligated to do that for some reason if it's like a biography. And I guess the one thing about Amelia that I really like is that it doesn't do that. You know, you get a flashback or two, but basically it just kind of takes this one episode, which is her first flight across the Atlantic, and really focuses on that. And I think it's a good tight story.
And if anything, if you've not had a chance to read Midnight Sun, here's a page from Amelia Earhart. Ben's graphic storytelling is so crisp, it's so clear, it's so wonderful, and you just do such a nice job. They're an absolute joy to read. And again, I know I laid on thick. I know I apologized a lot. I know I lost my question, but I think this turned out very well. And I can't help thanking you people for coming. And let's have a big round of applause for these four. Boots, they're all in the 400 and 500 range, correct? And the books are Mad Kid, Super Spy, and Two Sisters. And again, I've said it before, I was 2 inches taller before I read this book. Top of my head came clean off when I was reading it. We've got Houdini, which is not available here, but it's very, very highly recommended. Berlin, you have a copy of the...
I don't. We have volume two. I ran out of volume one, but we have volume two.
He's got they're available collected. I just love the size of these, and I just love getting the looking forward to these. And finally, we have got Bone Sharks, Cowboys, and Thunder Lizards. This is really a tremendous story. We've got Suspended in Language, which is really good, but again, it's very, very scientific. And it may not be to all tastes, and I'm saying that also because you don't have one available in here.
Yeah, but I sold out of those yesterday.
And folks, once again, thank you so much. Have a great, great day.
Yeah, these guys are awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Oh, just sold out yesterday.
Thanks. Oh. That's suspended.
Not that.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Oh, nothing. Appreciate it.